welcome to another edition of New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Todd Weir. In 1923, a report was delivered to the General Assembly of Scottish Presbyterians, which offered the following argument against continued Irish immigration to Great Britain. God placed the people of this world in families, and history, which is the narrative of his providence, tells us that when kingdoms are divided against themselves, they cannot stand. Those nations, homogeneous in race, were the most prosperous and were entrusted by the Almighty with the highest tasks. Where did the notion come from that God selected or created races for providential roles? One origin was a theory that the world had been inhabited by humans before Adam. The history of this theory, which formed at the intersections of science, religion, and colonial geography, is taken up in Adam's Ancestors, Race, Religion, and the Politics of Human Origins, which has recently been reissued as a paperback by Johns Hopkins University Press. Today is my pleasure to speak to its author, David Livingstone, Professor of Geography and Intellectual History at Queen's University, Belfast. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd.
So to get us started, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your background, what interest brought you to this project?
Right, sure. Well, when I began initially to get into intellectual history, I did a study of an American geologist, Nathaniel Shaler, who had taught geology at Harvard University in the second part of the 19th century. And he had, of course, interest in the earth sciences and the like, but also was fascinated by racial questions, not least in an era of immigration into the United States and things of that sort. So after I finished up working on Shaler, I always had this interest in the kind of intellectual history of what you might generally call racial science, interface with anthropology and so on. Now, as part of that, I came across a book with a curious title, Pre-Adamites, by another geologist who had worked in the American South called Alexander Winchell. Now, I turned to the final chapter of this book, and it gave a very inaccurate, it turned out, but intriguing brief intellectual history of the idea of there being human beings on Earth prior to Adam. Now, of course, in the American South, you can see that this would have all sorts of political potential because it could be suggesting that there were multiple points of origins for the human race, perhaps an Adamic line from Adam, but perhaps other beings on Earth that were not in that particular lineage. I should just say that Winchell himself did not adopt that multi-creation viewpoint, but he was in a culture where it was certainly widespread. So I pursued this just a little bit, as many years ago, back in the, I guess it must have been in the late 1980s or 90s, and wrote a little short technical monograph, about 90 pages or something, for the American Philosophical Society. But I always felt there was a much bigger story here. And a story that would be bring in many other strands that I've hitherto been able to uncover. So one afternoon I'm sitting in Berkeley with Ron Numbers, historian of science, and Ron is editing a new series for Johns Hopkins. And we begin talking about this, and he said to me, that little American Philosophical Society monograph, it was more like a special issue of a journal. Was probably buried on the shelves somewhere. He said, "What about writing a fuller history of this?" And I thought, "Yeah, why not?" And so from that point, it took me quite a few years to get the book finally published in the 2000s. Now it's been reissued. I went back to try and tell what I thought would be the whole story. Though we're not supposed to have aspirations towards meta-narratives anymore. So I had a go at this. Of course, I haven't told the whole story at all. But that's the genesis of the book and my own kind of story of how I got there.
Very good. What I think is fantastic about this book is the way that you examine these conversations between various disciplines, if we can call them that, theology, science in a general sense, but also discovery, climactic thinking, politics and so on. And you begin really in the age of discovery, right? In the 16th, 17th centuries. And you introduce us to this interesting figure, Isaac La Perrière, a French man of many talents, in an age of where science is really just one avenue of intellectual pursuit of these type of intellectuals. You introduce him as a heretic. So we're already at the exactly there between religion and science and discovery. Could you tell us a little bit more about La Perrière, what his heresy was, why he turned out to be such a sort of pivotal figure in the story?
Yeah. You're right. I do begin fundamentally with Perrière. And partly, I have to say, that is because there had been a historian of philosophy, Dick Popkin, who had been working on Perrière, and I had been unaware of this, and then he and I got in touch and so on. But of course, I do have to say, just as a sort of preface to that, Todd, that I'm sure if you go back into the early history of the Church Fathers and the like, and others, you'll find, if you're looking for comparable ideas that were existing. I mean, I think it's Perrière who really gets them on the agenda of the West, and it becomes a much more widespread notion after Perrière. And you're right, it's connected with the age of reconnaissance or the age of discovery and so on. But that is not separate from earlier interesting questions about whether other planets might be inhabited. So the notion of the plurality of worlds, excuse me, is already being discussed. And when Giordano Bruno finds himself actually executed for being a heretic, his idea that other planets might be inhabited was one of the charges that had been led at him. So there is a link between whether other worlds might be inhabited and the relationship between the different peoples that inhabit this world that we live in. So Perrière is reading, I think, two things that bring him to this notion. The first one, of course, as you quite rightly say, are the voyages of exploration. He is finding information about other, what I guess we might call ethnic groups, other peoples with markedly different bodily features and characteristics. So this leads him to ask the question, how could it be that these people would have come into being in the short space of time that would be available from a creation in 4004 BC. And by a variety of means, he thinks that's not possible. So he turns, of course, then to what were known as the pagan chronologies, the writings of other peoples, Babylonians and the like, to look at their origin stories. And he finds that many of them have a much longer history than the standard Judeo-Christian one. So this makes him begin to question whether there may be time before the recorded narratives in the Hebrew Bible. Could there be eons of time prior to the biblical narrative? So pagan chronology, geographical discovery, and whilst I'll not get into it here, a bit of sort of fancy exegetical footwork that's going on with the Bible itself, where he begins to think that it is composed of sometimes incompatible documents, that it has been brought together by editors of various sorts, ideas that lead to him sometimes being considered one of the early founders of biblical criticism, and I guess what would become redaction criticism, and so on. So he comes to this idea, could there be humans before Adam? And he believes that he can find internal biblical evidence that suggests, yes, there were. Now, heresy. How does he get the heresy? Well, it's quite hard to pin down exactly what his own religious viewpoints are. I think the prevailing view now is that he was Jewish, and that he had to, of course, hide his Jewishness and converted or pretended to convert to Protestantism. So if that's the case, that does make sense of a number of things. One is, it makes sense of the idea that he thinks only the Jewish people are the descendants of Adam. All the rest of us who are not Jewish are of non or pre-Adamic sources. So part of this was part of a political project in the 17th century to find homelands for Jews and to try to be engaged in a more positive attitude in an era of anti-Semitism. But he travels, and he travels to what is, would now be modern-day Belgium, gets picked up by, I guess, the papal policing service, and is taken to Rome and is found guilty of this heresy of querying the biblical narrative that all human beings are descended from Adam. Of course, the reason for that is that there's a lot of Catholic theology that's bound up with Adam as the first human, original sin, things of this sort. At any rate, he then he issues a recantation, but clever devil that he was, he structures it in a way that he never really denies that he thinks there may have been these other humans prior to Adam. So he spends the rest of his life in Paris quietly working on his theory. The book, of course, had already come out in 1655. Two books, in fact, Pre-Adamites, and then a second one on a theological system based on the idea of pre-Adamic humans. Heresy. This book, you scarcely find anyone that I can find, or other historians can find, in the 16th, 17th, and early 18th century, who support the idea, but you find refutation after refutation after refutation. This has led Dick Popkin to the thought that this idea really was much more challenging than the mechanical philosophy, much more challenging than the Copernican revolution, because it is striking at the heart of the identity of the human and the possibility that there might be different, shall we say, different kinds of humans on the face of the earth. That means that the notion of there being a single human nature is quite quickly up for grabs. So I think that takes us roughly to the Pereire intervention, if I can put it that way.
So moving along from Pereire, I mean, Pereire is also a geographer, yes, right? He has maps. He's very interested in the location of these various peoples and their movements, and correlates that to time. Those are obviously key themes in your work, time and place.
Yes.
It seems to me that geography has to do both with the locations in which theories are developed, but also with the parallel development of the whole field of geography. And you, moving into the 18th century, you pick up now somebody who, in a sense, is arguing against Pereire, but nonetheless is working in a very geographical framework, and that's Montesquieu. How does Montesquieu fit into the story?
Yes. Well, I'll backtrack a little to Pereire's geography first. I mean, he does become an expert on Greenland and Iceland. And he constructs some of the early maps and so on. And, of course, one of the puzzles is, does a place like Greenland actually connect with North America? And this is very, very important in his cartographic ventures and so on, because he became, as a consequence of this geographical work, very suspicious that indeed that North America could have been populated from people who lived in Greenland. So if that was not the case, he was not aware of the Bering Strait cross, the question then would emerge, as it had done for a long time, where did the peoples of the Americas come from? Prior to Columbus's encounter and the like, where did those people come from? So that's a fundamentally geographical question. So there's geography in this from the point of view of migration, settlement, linguistic distributions, and cultural connections. Pereira thinks an understated figure in that story, as a matter of fact, but I think he's very important. Geography comes in another way, and you've got it exactly right with the era of Montesquieu, because Montesquieu, I think, is crucially significant in advancing what might be too crudely called, but I think happily enough called, climatic determinism. So for Montesquieu, he makes the observation at one point, the empire of the climate is the greatest of all empires. Now, he has a theory that this is working through, it's almost kind of humoral theory, working through blood and things of this sort with heat and cold and so on. It can explain incidences of drunkenness, it can explain all sorts of things. But crucially, of course, it explains culture, legislation, and things of that that sort. But for this debate, I think what's crucially important is that the only option to the notion that human beings were separately created in different places would be to turn to climate as an explanation for somatic differences. So if you weren't going to adopt a multiple genesis thesis, a polygenetic account of the human race, if you wanted to maintain a monogenetic single point of origin for the human species, possibly from Adam, but certainly at least from one family, climate is your best explanation. It's a geographical explanation. And I think that in a strange kind of way, means that for a person who wanted to be a biblical literalist, the only way to account for human diversity was to be an evolutionist, because the initial humans obviously evolved under the regime of climate in some way to produce the remarkable racial varieties that exist in the present day. And this became a source of a very, very great debate in the 18th century. So
we're moving. Like, what I find again interesting about your account is the way in which you examine these kind of mutually influencing contexts between disciplines, types of discovery that are occurring. So we move with your story somewhat from the realm of geography in the 18th century and before, into other disciplines in the 19th century or around that time, and there are constantly sort of new challenges brought to this, both to the polygenetic account, but also to the monogenetic account. There's new pressures on this. The question of chronology seems to become increasingly important. What are some of these new pressures that are emerging from both the sciences, but also perhaps even politics or sociology, in that period between, let's say, the late 18th and the mid 19th century?
Well, can start with the politics one. I mean, I think that's a particularly interesting one. Of course, there are scientific questions, and we'll get to those perhaps in a minute. But let's deal with one of the political ones first of all. So late 18th century, the notion of let's just even say a plural human species with different points of origin begins to attract a few defenders. Most of them are pretty tentative about it, because this is still being refuted in Catholic encyclopedias, as a heresy. I mean, right into the 20th century, you can find an entry on pre-Adamites. I should just say in passing that the notion of pre-Adamites only matters for people who believe that Adam was a single human individual. I mean, so in one sense, it's a sort of conservative debate, the whole thing. So one figure who flirts with this idea is the Scottish jurist Lord Kames. And in his natural history writings, he flirts with the idea. Personally, I think he really believed it, but has a sentence or two in to kind of cover himself because he'd already been involved in some other heresy trial, and I think he didn't want another one. But anyway, he's suggesting that people were made for environments not that the environment's made the people. Right? So, politics. This is picked up in the United States, and it's picked up very, very, very soon after the signing of the American Constitution. And it's picked up by a man called Samuel Stanhope Smith. Smith writes what's really the first American anthropology text, and he rigorously follows the Montesquieu climatic explanation. So things like climate and then related things, diet, culture, habits, things of this sort, he thinks could perfectly well bring into being racial differences, which he literally believes are only skin deep. But when you get to the final pages of Smith's book, the politics come out very, very dramatically. And he attacks Keynes because his argument is basically this: if you have multiple origins of humans, what you sacrifice is a common human constitution. There'd be multiple constitutions. It's what I said earlier, you sacrifice a common human nature. So here's Smith sitting in newly born United States, looking for where can you find moral authority for your society. You've just overthrown monarchy. You've overthrown inherited privilege. You have overthrown an establishment of religion. The only place that you can look for an appeal to a moral basis on which a society might be able to meaningfully talk about and resolve its political and moral differences is what? A common human constitution. So, in a sense, I think that the fear for Smith is precisely a political one. How are you going to, in fact, he says something like that it would be impossible to govern a society composed of people whose natures were, I think his phrase is something like, originally and essentially different. Preserving a single human constitution, he thought, was fundamental to the political governance of particularly a nation like the United States, which progressively would have peoples from all over the world inhabiting it. So there's that critical political dimension to the whole issue. It gives a political edge, which I think is really very significant. Now, there's a second political edge as we move into the 19th century. I suspect this is, Todd, the one that you had in mind. Particularly in the United States, and this is where geography gets important, anthropology, physical anthropology as a discipline, is beginning now to flourish. Flourishing, actually, I think, in some ways, earlier for this type of work than in Britain. But there are several medical doctors, anatomists, who are working on the human body and on human racial differences. Josiah Knox, one of them. George Liddon is another one, and Morton is a third. And they link between anthropology and archaeology. By undertaking a huge exercise in the measurement of human racial differences, I mean things like skull shape, head size, curliness of hair, stature, and the like, a lot of these anthropometric measurements, they became very convinced that the human races were actually composed of different species. So polygenism gets a very strong hold in these early 19th century American anthropologists. Very, very much bolstered by a hyper-creationist, Louis Agassiz, who is a Swiss paleontologist at Harvard, the leading paleontologist perhaps in America at the time, and deeply critical of monogenism and later of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. So with Agassiz and these anthropologists, the idea of multiple human races gets a very, very firm hold in early American anthropology, particularly amongst a number of people in the American South. And you can see, of course, in an era anti-government America, you can see that at least for a certain number of people. Now, of course, it's never hugely shared because the biblical story of Adam has got quite a hold in the American South. But outside that group, there seems to be a perfect justification for racial hierarchy. Now, this, of course, is something that Pereire never had in mind. Pereire was using his notion of multiple Adams in a humanitarian way. All humanity benefited equally in the story of Adam and Adam's great successor, Christ, and the like. But in the American South, this did get a grip amongst a number of natural historians and a variety of institutions, because this did give a political justification for notions of superiority and inferiority, which would be marked by somatic differences, brain size, skull size, shape of head, and the like.
So we're still before Darwin.
Yeah.
Are these polygenesists thinking about a distant common origin or absolute different creations? I suppose there are different views on that topic.
Yeah, there'll be different views. I mean, you could, of course, have polygenesis with a recent creation. And in fact, you know, if you needed a recent creation, you're going to be very tempted to go for polygenesis. So you would have, roughly speaking, a Middle Eastern Adam, an American Adam, maybe a Chinese Adam, maybe an Inuit Adam or something of this sort. Because you don't have the... When you do that, you don't have to find mechanisms to explain the differentiation in such a short period of time. But by the early 19th century, I think that now all sorts of ideas are prevailing about a longer Earth history. That indeed the Bishop Usher chronology has evaporated a long time. We're now talking about thousands upon thousands of years. And maybe beginning to creep even up into the hundreds of thousands of years. And I think that the group of people that have been sometimes described as scriptural geologists, those who are saying, you know, the features of the earth were really sculpted by an enormous flood, the Mosaic flood and the like. I think they're quite a small group. Really, I think that many, at least in the Christian tradition, many people who were literate but relatively orthodox in their theologies had already accommodated or were accommodating reasonably well to a long Earth history. But the project also, then, for those who believed in a longer history of the Earth, Glidden, Naughton, and the like, and so on, who are much less tied to the Bible in any case, the arguments that they're putting forward now is that racial features are long-lasting and are deeply persistent. So they go back, for example, even to the period of the Greeks, and they find hieroglyphics and they find drawings of one sort or another that seem to show, shall we say, precisely the same racial differences that were still visible in their own time. So the notion of fixity of certain features is very deeply embedded in at least this early stage of the polygenist movement. And I think that even people like Agassiz, who has a very strong doctrine of divine creation, in a kind of transcendentalist Germanic Naturphilosophy, I guess almost Unitarian kind of a way. I mean, he's not thinking that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. I mean, he's a paleontologist and so on. But he thinks that these features are deep, historically deep, long-lasting, persistent. And so he's really thinking about a world that is, if I could coin the word, fixist rather than dynamic. So I think you could have a short Earth history, believe in a long Earth history, and still be equally committed to this notion of the persistence of species with persistent differences.
The in this chapter where you're talking about the these, you call them harmonizing strategies that are developed. Essentially, the pre-Adamism emerges as a a way of trying to harmonize scripture with discoveries in science in the 19th century. And I think you make an interesting methodological point there about the relationship of science and religion. There's a tendency in hindsight from the 20th century, say, to perceive this relationship as somewhat one-sided, that theology has to accommodate science. The science does not have to accommodate theology. You have a different take, and looking really, I suppose, at the historical impact of these harmonizing strategies, you make an interesting point about how the harmonizing strategies go back and feedback into both sides of the equation, yes, into science and into theology.
Yes.
And you have a nice little few sentences I just want to quote, because sure, I think they're very good. So this is the quotation. "Designed as they are to retain continuity between scientific discovery and theological beliefs, in fact, these harmonizing strategies are mutually transformative. They alter both the scientific and the theological architecture of their patrons. Reconciling schemes are not to be thought of as neutral, disinterested joints holding together two limbs, or simply as bridges between two independent domains. They are, rather, more like a solvent that dissolves two substances to produce a new compound."
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the term that Stephen Jay Gould used of non-overlapping magisteria, yes, to describe, I think this is a normative understanding of the relationship of science and religion, that they have their domains, they don't overlap, or they shouldn't, in his view. And your take is quite different as a historian, at least.
Yes.
Could you say a bit more about that?
Sure, yeah.
There are
lots of things to say about that. I mean, let's start with why I, at least historically, don't find, Gould's observation a useful historical strategy. I mean, and that might be Gould's view that they ought not to overlap, or that in overlapping where they do, they're violating some epistemic propriety or something of that sort. I pick up a book by William Darrell in the 17th century, say, or 18th, whatever it is. And so I read here about the way in which organisms are adapted to their environments. And he elucidates in some detail how that's the case. So you read this book, you'll learn a great deal of natural history about adaptiveness of features of organisms to fit them to the environment within which they find themselves. Now, on any sort of reasonable understanding, you would consider that, I guess, ecology, which is exactly what ecology does. The book is called Natural Theology. So my question is this a work of science, or is it a work of theology? Or is that the wrong question to ask? I mean, what we have here is a work which has, at the one and the same time, the author believes he is doing theology and finding out about the world. So asking him, you know, about noma, is it non-overlapping magisteria, I think Darren wouldn't understand what really you're talking about. So Steve might well have conceived of this as a way of dealing with what I would call the late 20th century culture wars. Whether it really does much work for periods at least before the 20th century, I'm not sure at all. And in fact, I think it's an open question as to whether or not you can map the boundaries of these domains clearly anyway, because I'm fairly persuaded of the arguments of the philosopher W.B. Galley, who argues that there are certain ideas that are essentially contested. In other words, you can't come up with a set of stipulations about what they're going to be. And science and religion are exactly those. I mean, which of us can define exactly what religion is and then, you know, draw a boundary around it, or the same for science? So that's to just take up the Gould point. Can I make 2 points about this segue? I've been thinking about it. One that perhaps you haven't mentioned, then I'll get to the one, Todd, that you have. Harmonizing strategies, of course, can either be successful or can fail. They either persuade people that they are good harmonizing strategies or they're not. What's interesting about this one is, it strikes me, that it begins as heresy. what we said at the beginning, that Pereira is conducted to Rome and recants and the like. If it's actually people are really tentative about this, it's regarded widely as a compromising of the biblical documents. But progressively in the 19th century, more and more people advance it, not to subvert the traditional biblical understanding, but as a harmonizing strategy that becomes more and more acceptable to more and more people that you might think of as very, very orthodox. So, I mean, I found it defended, for example, very strongly in the early 20th century by one person, name is actually going to escape me now, but one person who was very involved with the American evangelist D.L. Moody. Now, to move from something that was heretical to get this sort of rubber stamp of what you might think of as early 20th century fundamentalism shows that you can have a trajectory from heresy to orthodoxy with precisely the same idea. Now, the solvent, which is, I think, where you want to get to. So you're a person interested in human origins, and you're interested in the scientific question, whether humans emerged in one place, and are we all descended from them? Could humans have been created in different places? What way does descent work? So that's a scientific question. Seems to me this is a perfectly good scientific question. But you also have religious beliefs. And you're trying to reconcile with whatever way the science turns out, you're trying to reconcile theology with the science, and you're also trying to make your science coherent with your theology. So let's just say you opt for the view that human beings emerged or were created or came into being at different points across the face of the earth, so that all human beings are not descended from a single lineage. So I think that has theological consequences. It has theological consequences, for example, if you're in the Christian tradition, for the standard notion about original sin, particularly if you're a Catholic. So for Catholics, original sin is passed on by inheritance from our first parents, if you like, through to all one of us, every one of us. Well, how does that happen in a plural system? So then some theologians reply saying, original sin doesn't work that way. There was one historic Adam, and that fall from grace actually was one which you have to understand as acting in a representative way for all humanity. You don't need literal descent, but the action of the Adamic family would be acting in a federal way as representing all humanity. So what I'm saying here is you've adopted a scientific thesis and now you're doing some theology in order to try and work out the implications of this. It may have implications then for a person in the Christian tradition for their Christology. In the New Testament, you might get references to Jesus Christ as the second Adam. Do all the other non-Adamic peoples need to have their own Savior and so on? So, and it'd be exactly the same for a plurality of worlds. So here's a way in which buying into a thesis about origins will have implications for which theology you take, but it's also going to have implications for how you understand how human diversity comes about. Are you going to turn to climate? Are you going to think that human difference is deeply innate? Is it something that we could have control over? Is it something that we ought to have control over, and so on? So it just strikes me that when you adopt a particular scheme, it's doing scientific work and it's doing theological work for the person at the same time. So it's not just as simple as saying, let's have two separate realms here. The strategy that you opt for will have implications for the explanatory alignments that you're going to take on your empirical work and it will have implications for the way in which at least certain theological propositions have to be perhaps nuanced or transformed, maybe abandoned or even reinforced.
Great. And the point at which you introduced this idea fits precisely into this early 19th century period, where we're still talking about a period in which natural philosophy is considered part of the scientific project, potentially even natural theology. Yeah. But there is, as you describe in the book, I mean, even though there is this mutual influence of the fields throughout history, yeah, nonetheless, there is a major change in the mid-19th century. There is this growing disentanglement, I suppose, despite mutual interactions of the fields.
Yes.
That you call, you talk about the professionalization of science. Another point, you talk about the secularization of science. And it's probably no coincidence that Darwin's theory emerges in the mid-19th century and is part of that that change. Now, this creates a different playing field for the theories about pre-atomism, doesn't it? And
three separate things here. One, of course, is the significance of Darwin's theory right off, and maybe you want to return to that. So I'll leave that just aside for a minute. I don't know if you want to turn. I mean, that makes a big difference here, massive difference in all sorts of ways. So we should return to it. This is a period where there is the professionalization of science, and then you connect it up with secularization. Secularization is a very tricky term here, of course. You know more about that, Todd, than I do, given your own work. But one of the things that I think, a way that I like to maybe refer to this more is the naturalization of vocabulary. Now, why I say that is, I mean, let's take anthropology as an example. It professionalizes increasingly. So, if we're talking about the 1850s, 1840s, 50s, there is in Britain an ethnological society of Great Britain. And it had a kind of humanitarian, Quaker sort of background to it, following the perspective of people like Pritchard, for example, who was a major anthropologist at the time. And when you read it, I went back reading, looking for, does the name Adam appear? And of course it does. Even the word Adam's race, Adamic, this, that, and the other. So there is what Bob Jung would have called a kind of common context for the practice of science at the time. And of course, and in a sense, Darwin was perhaps part of this. A lot of natural history is carried out in this era by Parsons. And Darwin might have headed, for the life of being a Parson naturalist if he hadn't, headed out in the Beagle Voyage in the 1830s and that. But then you get a less humanitarian and more, if I say scientific, I mean, I'd be careful using that word here, but when the anthropological society comes in to being, it's rather more, and this might be an anachronistic word, but racist. It takes a tougher polygenetic line, and now I get to the naturalization of vocabulary. Very, very few references to Adam, Adamic peoples, and so on. Now, whether that means that progressively people don't believe in the Adamic picture, or whether it's no longer the right vocabulary to use in a scientific journal, raises the question of the relation between naturalization of vocabulary and secularization, as a sort of reality or whatever. The whole thing becomes progressively scientized and instrumentalized. A whole range of more sophisticated measurements are taken, and specially constructed instruments come into being. Anthropometric laboratories to measure racial differences and human differences come into being. There was one, for example, in Dublin that was very active in measuring somatic differences. And that has persisted right up to the present day. I mean, you know, now people want to get their own DNA tested in order that they can see what their lineage was, what part of the world they came from, what ethnic group they might be associated with, and so on. And I guess that whole project takes place outside the framework of what I was looking at here, this science religion notion of Adam and a pre-Adamic world. But that is definitely part of the history of a fascination with measuring human bodies and the way in which identity is bound up with the physical body, and identity is bound up with a sense of one's history. So I think that in this sense, genetics and genealogy actually belong in this story quite closely together. So those would be a few thoughts about that dimension. I don't know if you want to return to the Darwin.
Well, let's talk about Darwin, because you know, obviously, in a period of natural philosophy, as in philosophy in general, the room for speculation is very great, and you can have many competing theories. Whereas with Darwin, certainly, you know, his great German advocate Ernst Haeckel believed that he finally had the key to unlock his own natural philosophy. There was no longer going to be any question about whether or not this particular philosophical view of science was true. And I would guess that many people by the 1870s came to a similar opinion, that we had sort of crossed a boundary into a new realm of certainty when it came to these questions about origins and lineages. How does that change the story here?
Well, I mean, that is a really interesting and very, very large question. So, Todd, I'll sort of nibble around the edges of it, and then you can bring me back onto the track. I'm wandering too far away. Several things. First, you mentioned Ernst Haeckel, Haeckel is a great advocate of what he calls Darwinismus, and the great German advocate. But of course, there are profound differences here too, and one of them is on exactly the topic we're talking about, because Haeckel, without any religious concerns, much that I can see, is a very strong advocate of polygenism, a very strong advocate of different human races, whereas Darwin is usually considered as, conventionally considered as a person who really is the death knell for polygenism, because not only are all of us monogenetic, but we're all actually probably from just one or two pre-human organisms and so on. Never mind the tricky subtitle of The Origin of Species, which is about the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. But there's no doubt he introduces something that's quite new. So what's Darwin's project really about here? He does mention the creator in The Origin of Species. Then later he writes letters to say that he was only, and I think his phrase is, truckling into public opinion when he put creator in. So he slithers backwards and forwards. But what he's at least doing here is destabilizing many of the central notions that have been part of the debate. One is that this is no longer a fixist world. Universe. Dynamism, transformation is part of this. It's one in which the human is rolled into the history of all the rest of life, rolled into, shall we say, nature in that broad sense. So some particular stories. Okay, so in one sense, you can understand, if we go back to the American South, you can understand that insofar as the South might be considered a biblically literalist culture, they wouldn't have much time for Charles Darwin. And that's absolutely right. There's a famous case, which I'm writing about in another book, about Woodrow Wilson's uncle, James Woodrow, who was dismissed from his position in South Carolina for advocating evolution or even talking about it much to his students at the Columbia Presbyterian Seminary. But what about the more, what about the less orthodox, if I can put it that way? What about the Knott and Gliddons and the anthropologists? Well, they abominated Darwin because on one step backwards, blacks and whites become brothers and sisters. I mean, they're just minor differences. And so Darwin in American South, very different from New Zealand, but Darwin in American South is rejected because it would be seen to undermine the notion of human species that could be used to justify a political system. So we now know from the work of people like James Moore and Adrian Desmond, the argument is that a huge motivating force in all that Darwin did was the fact that he came from an abolitionist family. He also experienced firsthand the horrors of certain types of slavery in South America. And it's for this reason that he became a strong supporter of missionary societies, particularly in the South Pacific, trying to stamp out slavery of one sort or another. Does this make Darwin a modern egalitarian? Well, of course it doesn't. Darwin believes that there are superior and inferior peoples, and that as the processes of evolution would take on, certain groups would dominate over others in the human world in just exactly the same way that certain animals do invader species in the subhuman world and so on. But he introduces into this a new dynamic about a world that's much less stable, that in one sense, if there are hierarchies, there's nothing that is eternal or fixed about those. They may undergo transformation. Because what animates this whole thing is adaptation to environment, adaptation to environment. What suits an environment at one time might be deleterious in another one. And I think that introduces a world that's much less certain, progressivist, stable, and so on. So it sort of transforms the debate. But for those religious people who still retain the significance of Adam as a theological postulate, the pre-Adamites now can become a reconciling tool for a new problem, that is human origins problems in the Darwinian mode. An argument, the pre-Adamites might have been almost human. They are hominids, but they're not fully human. And in the early 20th century, many efforts were made to try to say something like this. If we think of Homo sapiens, or Homo sapiens sapiens, being exemplified in groups like Cro-Magnons. Should we think of the Cro-Magnons as Adamic and their predecessors, the Neanderthals, as pre-Adamites? So here you have the Adamites being roughly the modern human. Why is it important to preserve this among certain religious groups? Well, for this reason, there's a theological significance to Adam. So you think of the human race as, in theological terms, one theologian called this, the human being is not so much Homo sapiens, but Homo divinus, you know, a divine creation. That's Adamic. The pre-Adamites were not fully human creatures, but are subhuman hominids, which enables a reconciliation, as many did in the 20th century, early 20th century, with evolutionary anthropology. Does that begin to scratch around?
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Well, I was just thinking about, you know, I'm very interested in Ernst Haeckel. I mean, you know, Haeckel...
You know much more about than I do.
Well, Ernst Haeckel had this, you know, introduced a lot of vocabulary into science, biology, words like ecology.
Yeah.
Some terms that he used that probably didn't originate with him, but were current in his time, was the idea of the culture peoples and nature peoples,
yes,
as a way of differentiating between Europeans and the rest.
Yeah.
So essentially, Europeans bore culture,
yeah,
and the rest were part of nature.
Yes.
And you could see how, even though Haeckel denied Christianity and
yeah,
all of the biblical accounts, nonetheless, his ideas could fit quite well with what you're describing as the kind of the idea that chosenness for a certain race appears in recent history on top of a long history of evolutionary development as a sort of divine intervention. With Haeckel, it's not divine, but there still is a notion, there's a notion of chosenness, that there's yeah, a, you know, through the kind of Lamarckian ideas about how culture and biology interact, mm-hmm, this idea that certain races became bearers of culture, and that culture that they bore helped them develop biologically into superior creatures, so their brain size would have been improved and all this. So Haeckel could justify European imperialism based on this notion that the bearers of culture were essentially the avant-garde of the evolutionary process.
Yeah.
And they were bringing not just culture, but what is culture? Culture is self-consciousness of nature, of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they had a mission. They were chosen. They had, and there's a lot of analogies, really.
I think there are analogies, and they work very well. I mean, for example, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, as people in the Christian church are making these kind of accommodations or whatever, and I mean, one of the things that becomes pretty clear is that they want to make an argument that when you read the Genesis narrative, already the Adamic family are doing agriculture. They are already interrogating nature, you know, for the application of a culture, in this case, an agriculture and so on, which would exactly differentiate them from those who are closer to nature and who are much more part of nature. So, I mean, I think you're quite right to see this distinction. It doesn't have to be given a kind of religious gloss or theological gloss. And in the Christian tradition, of course, this absolutely could be used and was used, I think, I know a huge amount about this, for imperial purposes as well. I mean, you just have a theological layering on the top of this to be the bearers of culture to those who are much more almost enslaved to nature, never mind enslaved to natural passions and so on. So I think there are analogs there that you suggested the distinction isn't just a religious one, you know, but it's a much much wider kind of mentalité about thinking about the human's place in the natural order.
As we move sort of into the 20th century, in your book, you then discuss notions by racists. You focus, I think, particularly on American thinkers in this regard. Notion that this theory of pre-Adamism or pre-Adamites has certain consequences for the relation of races today. I'm talking 1900 or even potentially today.
Yes.
But in terms of racist thinking, how do they make that argument that that pre-Adamism has a moral lesson when it comes to the relation of the races in America in the year 1900?
Well, I thought you were going in a slightly different direction, and maybe I'm not quite getting this, but I mean, in the 20th century, of course, well, and I suppose you could say 1900 as well, but on into the 20th century, let me say two things. One is that there is, in America, in the late 19th century, a series of viciously racial works of propaganda that lead to a number of really, as I've said, you know, vicious disputes. Because one of these is that to the extent that you make a marriage between pre-Adamites and a pre-hominid group, there were a number of people who were using this theory literally to dehumanize African Americans, dehumanizing them by saying that African Americans are pre-Adamic, therefore do not have certain of the spiritual and maybe psycho-spiritual features that Adam and Adam's successors do possess. So some were going so far as to rule African Americans outside the arc of what the human was, literally bestializing with some very, very vicious and vitriolic language. As I say, this is a stunning departure from Pereire's original use. It shows how remarkably versatile this quite simple idea is. You say, I mean, Adam's not the first man, there are people before him. It can go in all sorts of, it goes viral in all sorts of directions. Raises another interesting question about when those of us who do historical work are writing about groups of this sort, how should we write about them? To what extent should we make moral judgments? Is our task to understand the, shall I say, vicious other, to understand them or to castigate them? Where this became really tricky for me was the perpetuation, even more tricky for me was the perpetuation of these ideas in the late 20th century. Shall I say just a
little? Yeah, give us a couple words about that.
I'm sitting one afternoon at my laptop, or desktop, I think perhaps it was, coming near the end of my research for this book. And I go on to a network that has hooks into many secondhand and used bookstores around the world. And I think, look, just type in pre-Adamite to see what happens. It spat out at me something like 10 books that I'd never heard of before. I mean, I thought I was becoming an expert in this, and I thought, I've got to track these down. So I tracked them down, and they all came from a single bookstore in Missouri. They were all talking about pre-Adamites, and they were talking about polygenesis, and so on. And these were published in the 1990s, 2000, and so on. It turned out that they were books advocating forms of pre-Adamism from the very far right, a Klan, neo-Nazi group, and so on. So I tentatively ordered a few of these online, wondering if I'd be safe doing so. But they turned out to be just little pamphlets, often run off locally and so on. With really nauseating racism justifying all sorts of things, bestializing people and so on. But I then discovered also this group are reprinting some of the 1900s works that had already been talking about and claiming these people, I mean, including Winchell, whom I mentioned earlier on, his pre-Adamite books, and a man called Carroll and so on, reprinting these for contemporary political purposes. And then that raised a different moral dilemma about how do you write about that vicious other in one's own day. This was quite surprising to me, but showing that pre-Adamites have this stunning capacity to survive in certain environments. Maybe Darwin would say they're adapted to certain environments, but still amongst certain far-right extremist, probably militaristic groups, these ideas still have a stunning sort of cachet right up to the present day.
Great. Well, I guess that is a good summary word on the on this book. But I would just be interested if you could just maybe in a few moments tell us about something you're working on now.
Yes. Well, thanks for the chance to do that, Tom. I just finished a book which is going to be the theme of the Gifford lectures that I'm giving in a few weeks' time, called Dealing with Darwin. And this book is looking at Presbyterian readers of Darwin in different locations, American South, North United States, Britain, and so on, and looking at fairly specific communities to see what did they make of Darwin. The conventional way to approach this would be to assume that this is a story about science and religion. And of course, it is a story about science and religion. But what turns out to be the case is that in every one of these cases, the way they dealt with Darwin and the dealings they engaged in with Darwin were much more a product of their local cultural politics than anything that was to do with sharing the same theology. They all share the same theology, they do the same theology, but they deal differently with Darwin. Mm-hmm. My question was why? And in every case, what looks like a science, religion, Christianity, evolution dispute turns out to be really a surrogate for something else. It's a vehicle for channeling other kinds of anxieties, whether they be about identity, whether they be about race, whatever they may be, who's going to control education and so on. So it's to kind of say we've got to dig underneath what appears on the surface as a science-religion dispute to figure out what's going on. So, you know, I'm looking at the three concepts: place, politics, and rhetoric in these disputes. So that's one that I'm just sort of about finishing up now. The one I'm supposed to be working on is a book that I'm going to entitle, which connects with some of the things we've been saying, using Montesquieu, The Empire of Climate. What I'm interested in this book, if I ever get around to finishing it, is the notion that in some profound way the human has been inexorably shaped by climate. It takes two forms, this. One is I want to do an intellectual and social history of the idea of climatic determinism from the ancient world up to our own day. Many people, of course, have refuted this over the years, going back, you know, from Herodotus and Hippocrates up through Falconer and Montesquieu, Ellsworth Huntington, and so on. But what I think gives this more of a bite in our own day is this issues about climate change. And what I'm finding here is, alive and well, what I'm calling climate change determinism. So, okay, we have changed the climate through various anthropogenic means. But the great fear is that climate is now going to punish us. So I'm amazed at the degree to which climatic determinism of an old sort has been resurrected in an era of rightly fears about climate change. I mean, just one example, maybe is all I need to do here. Historically, there was a long sense of people feeling that temperament temperament traits could be very significantly modified or determined or conditioned by climate. Particularly, say, violence. Certain environments would produce people that were much more violent. Even certain weather at a time of year might make people more prone to violence and so on. But that notion about climate and violence is now, I think, a very scary way, surfacing amongst national security agencies who think that climate change is going to bring war. It might be, it's not going to work through psychology this time, but what it's going to say is once you get climate change, you're going to get climate migrants. Once climate migrants come across the borders, we better get ourselves prepared now for warfare. So I'm interested in the kind of intellectual genealogy of an idea like that is now dominating governments. If there's climate change, we better get prepared for aggression, we better get prepared for war, and so on. And I think I want to be critical of this not overly critical, but what is it that humans have persistently felt that in some crucial way our fate reduces to climate? In one sense, it seems quite a silly idea. On the other hand, it seems to me to be remarkably alive and well, whether you're thinking about global economics, whether you're thinking about human health and so on, whether you're thinking about warfare, whether you're thinking about human origins, in so many of these arenas, when you trace it back, ultimately you're getting back to a climatic explanation. And I'm kind of interested why that should be the case.
Well, sounds like a fantastic book. I look forward to reading that.
We'll see.
So thank you very much for giving us so much of your time. And hopefully we'll have a chance for another conversation in the future.
Well, thanks for the conversation. I've enjoyed it, Todd, and I hope your listeners do as well.
Thank you.
Cheers.